I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about the future. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island, on this fresh edition of On Ice, Ideas, Creativity, Edge. Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University and I invite you to ask questions with us as we interview futurist Dr. James Canton, affiliated with the MIT Media Lab, NASA, and author of this new book, Future Smart. His goal is to clue in everyone on what he thinks is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. Get ready, he says, for a totally connected planet, a different kind of job market, new digital currencies, lifespans of 150 years on average. Climate change will be our next world war, predicting health problems in our bodies instead of just reacting to them. How will you, your family members, or your business fit into what Dr. Canton says is coming? At the very least, he wants you to be informed so you can watch as it unfolds and position yourself in the smartest way you can. We're still wondering how everyone on the planet will have a smartphone and digital access. You can use your phone in this hour at 203-776-WNPR. What do you think we need in the near future? Dr. Canton consults for Fortune 1000 companies and world governments. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. So let's get into this. If you would please describe how and when the entire planet will be digitally connected.
I think within less than 3 years, all major markets, economies, governments, and over 7 billion people will be connected in some way, every day, in some way, everywhere, in some way, through electronic media, or media that is wireless. So that means everything from video cameras that watch you to sensors that pay attention to you to devices like computers or cell phones that are aware of your location or that you are connected through either things you're wearing or places you're going and walking or your activities virtually and digitally, you will be connected.
Just a quick question on this. When I was reading your book last night, fascinating, and I thought to myself, we haven't yet done that. And I think, why not? I leads me to differing political philosophies in Congress and around the world, whether people want to spend money. How do you go into places? You talk about Africa in your book, like the remote regions of Nigeria or the Middle East, and make sure that how will people be connected?
Well, as I said, few people realize that the Earth is blanketed by a variety of satellite technologies. In fact, most of your communications in Africa, Asia, even in North and South America is connected to certain satellite and or technology and communications that's under the sea. There's a vast network under the sea of communications technology, a vast network orbiting the planet, and of course we're all carrying various devices. And most people are they're videotaped or they are captured in some form, either by digital bots when they're online or when they're talking on their phone or they're traveling in and out of the mall, let alone on the highway. So there's various ways or this convergence of different communication technologies that sense, are aware of our location. I mean, every single car that's been produced, any car that was purchased within the past even 5 years, 7 years, has internet capabilities already showing up on some grid someplace. So again, we're already connected in the industrial world, and of course the developing world increasingly will be closer, get closer to that kind of connectivity for the rest of us.
Rich Hanley, you have a question?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Rich Hanley from Quinnipiac University. You know, it seems that that creates two management issues. One, how do you manage this massive data flowing into our servers and whatnot regarding location, behavior, and so on and so forth? And Two, politically, how do you manage that? In the sense that we, you know, we do have, you know, members of Congress who are gladly admit they don't use email, which is an elderly technology, given the accelerating pace of technological development. How do you see this as a management issue, on both the political, you know, and in the business end?
Well, when you say management, if it comes to government, if you're referring to regulations, I assume that's what you mean.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So let's just put it in perspective. All of these technologies are so far ahead of our government, are so far ahead, particularly of Congress, that I don't think there is a management issue, nor am I calling for one in my book, Future Smart. So I think government kind of needs to, particularly Congress, needs to kind of get with, you know, what's happening, the digital main street, and catch up and see what's going on, and they're not. Because that's where all the jobs are going to be driven by, and entrepreneurs and new industries and all of that. But I do think that when you say manage the what I refer to as the data tsunami, the management of multiple terabytes, 100 plus terabytes of data that comes in, that's available from social media, from the internet, from the web, to mobile, is already being managed. Being managed mostly by autonomous agents, being managed by machines. Smart machines will manage this just the way they're managing it today. They'll just do it a whole lot better. And us humans can peer over the shoulders of smart machines to be able to extract data and monetize that data and turn it into new businesses for financial services, doing better health care, maybe finding the future of cancer, healing different kinds of diseases, and predicting health. So, again, we're headed towards, you know, an era where every organization, every business is actually in a data business. If those that don't know it, I think are at a competitive disadvantage.
I'm with Rich Hanley for an Ideas and Innovation show we call On Ice. Our guest is futurist and consultant Dr. James Canton, affiliated with the MIT Media Lab and NASA. His new book about what's coming is called Future Smart. This statement in your book really caught my attention, and Rich, this will be especially interesting for you with all those students around you, that the economy will have, the majority of workers will all be freelancers?
That's correct. I see the freelancer or entrepreneur part of the economy driving most of the jobs. Now, some of these entrepreneurs, many of these freelancers, will be working for big companies as well as the smaller networks of companies and collections of companies, kind of digital koretsus, meaning networks of global companies made up of freelancers that come together for projects and then go their separate ways onto other projects when that project's over. But I do think that that is the future forecast I have for the nature of work. This idea of working for a company or even two or three companies for the rest of your life, I think, is not going to be as attractive. And you can see this now. Most of the millennials, the highest percentage of millennials, once they leave college, the greatest percentage, 80% plus, I've seen as numbers as high as 90%, are working for startup companies or are acting as free agents, freelancers, so they can have more control over their work ethic, their time, their projects, and who they work with. But I see that as a dominant trend in transforming work and organizations, if not business, in the near future. It's going on right now. It's already started.
Do you think that that transformation, which I agree with you, is underway, and I think it's underway in ways that we can't even see yet, will have any social disruption component to it, just in the sense where you're trained to work at a company for 3 years, then go to the next level, and so on and so forth. A little anxiety, that sort of thing, to fuel any disruption.
What about Social Security? You know,
all those things.
I think it'll create disruption for organizations. I think it's going to create a disruption for many businesses who have invested in talented individuals. Who are now dependent upon those individuals to compete in the marketplace. They may be performing an important function, whether it's, you know, in accounting, customer service, sales, marketing, management, you name it. I think the anxiety, there's a power shift that's going on that's not well recognized, and I herald this in my book.
Right.
the power shift used to be, you know, getting a job. Wow, you know, so the power was with the employer, the companies that are hiring people, and you'd get a job and you'd stay for a long time and want to hold on to it. And this power has shifted to the talent, to the individual. And I think if there's any anxiety, I would say it's on the side of business. Businesses are struggling to figure out how to retain talent, acquire talent, keep talent happy, change their environment to be able to, you know, create a more flexible situation for keeping their talent engaged. And those that are not able to do that, and I see this right now, are losing talent very quickly. They're, for the higher level knowledge workers, knowledge engineers, there are many, many, many more job opportunities than people realize, number one. And two, companies are competing around talent, not just within their industry, but between different industries. And that's, again, another trend I point out in my books.
Yeah, you know, I have a friend who was just got a buyout, and they were offering buyouts to so many employees at this big, big media company in New York. And this friend took the buyout, and so the department, there was really nobody left. And in the end, they said, wait a minute, can we rescind the buyout? And my friend said, well, no, what do you mean? And they said, well, we don't have any institutional memory now. There's no one there in this very important department you were in. So I think that's not very insightful.
No, it's not. But I would say, speaking on behalf of future freelancers of America, I would say if you're graduating from business school, or you're really graduating from your undergraduate, or you're on your way facing what some people think is a tough environment, having many more skills and looking at opportunities from a freelancer perspective is going to give you a lot more flexibility, a lot more agility, and quite frankly, be able to write more of your ticket. I've been keeping my eye on a number of my godkids who are now in their 20s. And, you know, they've got very interesting jobs working for some of the biggest corporations. But, you know, they think, well, you know, I'll work maybe for another 2 years, and you know what, I'm going to move on to something else. And many of them want to start projects. Some of them are living in Asia. I mean, I think it's a very vital time to be an entrepreneur and maybe even work at a company for a period of time. But corporations are really not ready to deal with this power shift, and they better get what I call future smart if they're going to be able to retain and attract talent.
Okay, stay where you are. I want to get into medicine a bit on the other side of this break. Dr. James Canton, a futurist affiliated with the MIT Media Lab and NASA. His book is called Future Smart, and we have lots more to tell you about that's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years from his perspective. Stay with us. Faith Middleton with Rich Hanley, and our guest is consultant and futurist Dr. James Canton. He's a consultant to the Fortune 1000 companies, world governments, affiliated with the MIT Media Lab and NASA. His new book about what's coming is called Future Smart, and it's pretty interesting reading. So you say, and this will open a can of worms, that the next world war for us will be climate change.
That's correct. People underestimate the impact of climate change on the planet. In my book, Future Smart, I try to give the reader an understanding of the wide scope of climate change that's occurring. Let me give you an example. So in the Arctic is melting. So, of course, you hear a lot of media and press about, you know, the wildlife beginning to be at risk, or even starting to maybe even disappear, or the recession of the ice and the melting caps. What you don't hear that much about is that, you know, the Arctic has a plethora of resources, oil, gas, other natural resources that are now accessible. It also will open up entire trade routes on the top of the world. And it's also hotly contested. There are Russia, the United States, Finland, even China. There are nations now that are beginning to recognize that with climate change, you're going to get access to a part of the world and the resources of a part of the world. And the question, of course, is, you know, who owns those resources? Because it cuts across a lot of people's territory. You even have a Russian, as I point out in my book, you have a Russian adventurer who's claimed, he's put the Russian flag on top of a glacier on the bottom of the ocean. So,
Right. Again,
the Arctic, you're going to see also failed states. Climate change is going to devastate certain parts of the world. You're going to see a lot more conflict zones and failed states, which will lead to migration. We call them climate change refugees in Africa and maybe even parts of the Middle East due to climate change. And that will create a competition over resources, competition for power, and will exasperate conflict on the planet. That's what I refer to.
Yeah. There is, in terms of medicine, you talk about this way of that we will be able to predict what illnesses are starting in our bodies. Can you explain, rather than just reacting to them after the fact?
So our medicine today is fairly primitive. It's not more than, you know, 150 years old. So most of what happens with us with disease happens downstream. You know, you get a lump, you get a problem, you get a rash, you get a particular condition, and you go into the emergency room where you call your doctor. It's after it's already happened. Imagine a medicine that has the ability to do real-time diagnostics. Imagine a medicine that can be wirelessly scanned. So most disease occurs at the genomic level and occurs at the atomic level, meaning it recurs at a very small, tiny part of us in either our DNA or as DNA is expressed or not expressed. In other words, there are ways to be able to sequence our DNA and be able to have a much deeper dive into diagnostics, this real-time diagnostics. So therefore, before a condition turns into a cancer or turns into diabetes, we would be able to have an ability to be able to diagnose this, early diagnosis, and then be able to start treating it to stave off a problem. I mean, you think about what's going to kill most of us after, in terms of disease, is, you know, cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. We have the chance in our era to actually predict and actually prevent almost 80% of all illnesses. That could make a big difference. And we're not quite there with cancer yet, but we're certainly there with diabetes. And when it comes to cardiovascular disease, we're beginning to get there. So these could be managed diseases on one hand, but they also might be diseases that we could prevent if we can get upstream. And that's the excitement of the era we're in right now.
What is the upstream? What's the next big thing that has to happen?
Well, the research into there's a couple different areas that are really critically important. One is, as I said, early diagnosis. Most Americans, you know, see the doctor maybe, you know, once a year, once every 2 years for a checkup, unless they're not healthy. You know, that's just an invitation for disaster. When you go in to see the doctor, the kind of diagnosis they do, or let's say diagnostics they do to get a diagnosis, is very superficial. We need much better technology for early diagnostics so that we can learn sooner, faster. Everybody should have their DNA sequenced. Everybody should be able to routinely, at least twice a year, be able to get a good overview. And you're going to see new companies emerging that will do tests on you to give you some insight of where you are. But quite frankly, the medical infrastructure and industry is not there yet because the science is not quite there yet, but it's getting there. The other really exciting area is stem cells. You know, if you put these together, being able to predict when you might have an organ failure or you've got the dysfunction of a particular organ. So stem cells injected into your body from you, your adult stem cells, reconstituted and then put back into your body to address either a problem with your leg, your knee, your heart, your lungs. We could be talking about building customized organs in our lifetime, which would extend life. we have 200,000 people a year that die because they can't get the organs they need. Mm. We're talking about a major revolution.
Dr. Rich Hanley, again, one of the issues I have is funding. Is this? I mean, the technology is certainly accelerating to the point where your ideas are going to happen if the funding is in place. Is this going to come money from venture capitalists, major corporations that want to protect themselves, hedge against the future, or will it come from some hybrid government, venture, corporate source? What do you see that funding coming from?
Well, it's a good question. So the funding is going to come from it's going to be available based on where you are in the world. So if you're in a nation that is depopulating, all right, so I'm going to make all of you designated futurists for the next couple of minutes here, right? So if you're in a population that's depopulating, meaning fertility is low, immigration is low, and you're trying to keep your society moving forward, and you're running out of people to work, right? You're running out of people to create that strong GDP, that engine of growth. You're going to be more interested in providing great health care that will increase anti-aging, increase longevity, keep people healthy, and predict disease, and manage that disease longer. So you're going to find places like Singapore on the leading edge of, you know, predictive medicine and longevity. Mm. You're going to find places in Europe that, you know, they really have an interest in the Middle East. But so certain governments will pay, one. Two, corporations. You're working for a corporation. You think let's say IBM wants to lose these people. So incentives by corporations who are already paying for healthcare, our corporations going to pay, government's going to pay some, and then the individuals will pay. You may pay for care that is offshore. You know, I advise a hospital system, the largest private hospital system in Bangkok, actually in Asia, called Bumrungrad. You can get a knee fixed there. You can get treatments that cost three times as much in the United States. You can get there. We're going to start to see other offshore areas where not only can you get treatments at a fraction of the cost, but also health enhancement, cognitive enhancement, ways of where individuals will kick in along with their employers, kick in along with the government, to be able to provide a next level of enhancement, not just to, you know, fix something, but enhance the capability of it. How many people would like to have total recall or live an extra 25 to 50 years with the vitality of a 25-year-old? I don't think people realize we are about to turn the page with rejuvenation, regenerative medicine, where we will actually be living longer than any species, any humans have ever lived on the planet. Your kids today will live to see the 22nd century.
So, Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. Particularly the aging populations of Germany and Japan would be ripe for this sort of technology.
China.
But what about the United States? The United States kind of fits in halfway here. It's got an aging population, certainly, but it has, you know, a vitality and a vital infrastructure in terms of entrepreneurial capitalism and so on and so forth. What about for the United States? Where do you see that in terms of health, going?
Well, the United States is in great shape. I mean, we will. My forecast is we'll have a population growth primarily due to immigration, but the U.S. is actually sitting pretty. There's a couple of different reasons for that are all about health, but you wouldn't normally think about them. And let me try to make the connection for you. So we are, for instance, the U.S., North America, is energy independent today. Most people don't realize that. We're energy independent today with gas and oil, and we'll be building on more renewables. But we're energy independent today. That's number one. It's very important. Two, we're isolated from the rest of the world. Three, GDP, economic growth, productivity is at least 2 to 3 points greater than Europe. We're doing fine here, okay? And for all intents and purposes. But most of the breakthroughs in healthcare are going to happen in the United States because of our investments in research and development, particularly nanoscience, neuroscience, IT. What's next for, you know, next generation biotechnology for creating new generations of drugs? So I think the United States is going to be doing very nicely. But at the same time, there's not going to be as much impetus, for instance, to make every kind of breakthrough above and beyond just fixing health. So again, therapeutic approaches where we kind of, you know, help people deal with and manage disease is different then augmentation, or what I refer to as medical enhancement. And that's an order of development that I think that, you know, stem cells, regenerative medicine, I think that that you may end up having to find resources outside the United States, not just in the United States.
Mm, that's so interesting. It reminded me of AARP. To me, shockingly, ran a list. It came here to the office of all the places you could get surgery outside the United States. And I thought, wow, I can't believe AARP has just done this.
And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about it is that the global network that's in place now, you know, through various, you know, means, various instruments, will help, you know, transfer that technology from Germany, Japan, Singapore to the United States. We'll have global groups working on these issues and working on them in real time. That is, the capacity to transfer knowledge and information right now is still at its infant stage in terms of the network. I imagine 5 years where everything's in the cloud, things will just accelerate that much faster.
Well, yes and no. I mean, as I said earlier, Bumrungrad Hospital in Thailand has got 1,300 U.S. certified, American certified doctors, right? And they're able to move forward in terms of innovations around the cloud, as you mentioned. But the really interesting thing is, you take Japan. You mentioned Japan, right?
Right, I did.
So
yeah.
In Japan, where they do it, it's kind of an experiment in depopulation. Not only are they depopulating really quickly, but they've already recognized that they're not going to increase immigration. So their investments, because of their kind of uber aging society, is to invest in smart machines and robotics, because they recognize that they will be taken care of by robots. They'll be taken care of by smart machines. You're going to see this fusion of the cybernetic fusion of humans and machines occur. Some places it'll happen faster than others. I mean, I would forecast that within 5 years you'll visit hospitals in Japan and these kind of residential living environments that will be populated by elderly people, but also a whole lot more caregivers who are robots. How many of us are ready for that robo future?
Well, I think that's a critical cultural question. I really don't know.
Well, I'm a little bit speechless.
Yeah, that's an important, I think, a question, you know, to try to struggle with, you know, because we are heading in this direction. The evidence is overwhelming, as Dr., you know, points out in his book.
So the book is Future Smart, and this is Dr. James Canton. And you're listening to this right now either as a podcast or online as a radio experience, home, car, on your walk. So what do you see? Where's media going fastest? Where in 5 years, what's going to be going on?
In terms of the media?
Yeah.
Well, in the media, that's an interesting word. So I think the word is transmedia is going to be evolving. Mm-hmm. You're going to have we're going to have to redefine that whole concept of media, because media could be consumer generated media. You could have your own, you know, you have a podcast and a radio show today. You could tomorrow be broadcasting into space, or you could have entire media shows that are designed by computers, by algorithms. You have IBM's Watson, who's going to be used not just for healthcare but for entertainment. You could have a whole new media technology and communications platform on your mobile device, your wearable device, virtual realities that are designed by both artificial entities as well as human beings have nothing to do with the existing establishment today. They could end up being tomorrow's Steven Spielberg's, and movies could be produced for, let's say, pennies compared to millions of dollars. All of that technology, because of Moore's Law, you know, every technology is doubling in power every year. And that same period of time, it's reducing in price point by 50%. So, you know, when I was at Apple Computer working with Steve Jobs, we were bringing out the first Macintosh, the first real personal computer. It was $2,300 for less than 30 megahertz at a black and white screen. Well, today, $2,300, wow, that buys you a supercomputer. It buys you a computer that could run a bank. Yeah. You could run a nation. You could run a war. You could run a hospital. I mean, people don't realize just 30 years ago, I mean, we just invented the Internet about 5 seconds ago. And there's revolutions that are happening all around us. Most people going happily in their day don't realize they're happening. They're all based on computer chips.
Right.
I mean, wireless devices are massive supercomputers. So the next 5 years, media is going to be a very different kind of experience. It's going to be something that people produce. You could have media entrepreneurs. You could have people, you know, produce your own version of Game of Thrones instead of it taking, you know, 8 months to produce with thousands of, you know, extras and expensive actors and producers costing an average show of, you know, be $10 million. It might cost less than $20 because the technology is so easily available, and it lives in the cloud.
Is the Apple Watch just a blip on the screen or a big, big thing happening?
Exactly. I want to listen to this podcast on my new Apple Watch, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, but is it a big thing? Is this a big moment?
It's a big moment. People don't realize, you know, they're forecasted to sell 20 million. You know, Apple does very interesting things. You know, in Silicon Valley, where is near my home in San Francisco, companies operate a little differently. You know, we try things, throw them out there. When you're the largest company in the stock market, such as Apple, and you don't have to be, you can afford to throw some interesting things out there to see what happens. So, you know, Google threw Google Glass out there, and the wearables, just so they could learn from all of us. It's a big focus group. Apple's going to put out there. Mm. Apple did the same thing with Apple TV, right? Apple TV, not a lot of people heard about it. They put it out there. Lo and behold, it's now gotten traction. Apple's going to throw out there the Apple Watch, right? They're going to learn from all of us what makes, you know, pardon the pun, but, you know, what makes it tick. They don't have all the answers, Apple. They're going to crowdsource all of us to figure out with them what we want.
Everything's a beta.
Big deal? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Not tomorrow, not right away, but you will be wearing computers. Computers will be inside of you, digested by you. You'll be wearing them, and it'll be part of this ubiquitous global connectivity I talk about in my book, Future.
Here's what I want to know on the other side of this break we're going to take now from you, James Canton. With all these billions of people being able to go online and create their own shows and ideas and movies and you name it, how does everybody else find you? If that's growing exponentially, how do we find each other? Stay with us. We're going to answer that question and so much more on the other side of this. I'm Faith Middleton, loving this show with Rich Hanley, because we are talking with Dr. James Canton, and he's author of this book, Future Smart, which is a very interesting read, and he is a futurist, as you can tell, and also a consultant to the Fortune 1000 companies and MIT Media Lab, NASA, worked at Apple. You know, he is clued in, and he's done this book on what we need to know about what's coming in the next 5 to 10 years and beyond, so that everybody can be positioned in personal lives and business and see this unfold and get a feeling so that everybody's not dislocated by all of this. It seems like we're in a time of such change as we went from agricultural to the machine age. You know, everything's at hyperspeed. And so we happen to be alive during this time, James Canton, it seems to me, when and we've made one of these giant leaps. And that is both exciting and challenging for people. What do you think?
Well, I do. I think it's an exciting time. There's many different kinds of disruptions. Not everybody is kept pace with all the changes. Not everybody's ready for all the changes that are coming. That's a big part of why I wrote Future Smart, was to say, you know, hey, here is what's coming. And your ability to manage these game-changing trends is going to be the difference between you being successful or not, whether it's in your job or your relationships or your creativity or, you know, your occupation or your education. So these changes are coming, and the thing about it is, change for our grandparents' era was fairly somewhat episodic, but it was long cycles, right? And then for our parents' generation, it became a little faster, right? You know, you had a world war here and there, you had conflicts, all of a sudden global mass media emerged. And now what's going on is as we move forward, there's a lot more change that's going to happen, a lot more disruptive technologies, and there's a lot of things that, quite frankly, we need to do as individuals to become game changers of the future. That's really what I'm calling for in my book. We've got to become more, learn faster, experiment more. We've got to embrace these trends and find ways to be able to make them work for us, if you will, and not expect that, you know, the world is just going to deliver us, you know, a ticket to a great society.
I was thinking about a doctor who was on the show, and I said to him, what is health to you? And he said, the ability to adjust to the circumstances you're faced with. Those are the people who are the most healthy, whether they have five more minutes to live or a long time, they're going to recover. It doesn't matter. And I think that's what you're saying, that it's the same thing with how society changes, this ability to adjust and stay open to the best of your ability. So all this media, all this
content.
Yeah. So how do people find each other? How do they find the best? Who is curating everything? How is that going to go?
You know, it's an interesting question. Thanks for asking it. So up to now, most of digital communications, digital technology, has been something you have to do to make it work, right? You got to turn your phone on. You got to, you know, push that button in your car if you want to talk to somebody in the cloud. You've got to, you know, turn the computer on. You've got to go ahead and go to Google or another search engine and kind of do the heavy lifting to go search through stuff. Now imagine a different world. Imagine a world where intuitive technology goes ahead and pays attention to what your needs are. And you don't have to necessarily, you can use your voice, you can go ahead and even use your thought waves to be able to interact with the technology. But more importantly, more fundamentally, technology, particularly let's say the internet is a good example, could be your phone, could be a car, could be a wall in the mall, could be on the side of a billboard. It pays attention to you. You can activate technology that it will find you, it will know you, it will interact with you, it will predict what you're looking for and help you. It'll be a curating platform around you to help you and enable you kind of do what you want to do. Let's say
the world's going to be a giant mood ring.
Well, not quite. Let me give you an example. So, for instance, let me put together this concept with I don't know if how many of our listeners know what a mood ring is, you know? I may be one of the only people that knows what that is. God, my mood ring, and the one I'm wearing right now is going purple. Wow. Must be resonating with my chakras. Anyway, so let me put my halo aside for a moment and just say, all pun intended, that, you know, let's say I enjoy working at home, and I want to build a business that is. I want to be an entrepreneur and leave working for a company. Let's say, and I've got an idea about creating a pair of sneakers that shows I'm from the East Coast, so I can use that word.
Sneakers. Yeah.
People know what I mean, right? That there's running shoes. We call this out in California, and I want to create a pair of sneakers that are absolutely new. And what they do is they have materials that kind of adjust to the user, and maybe they have a voice chip in them, and they light up in a certain way based on if I'm running the right way or walking the right way, and they communicate with my internet site. They let me know, kind of update on my exercise. Well, that doesn't exist today, right? But I could create a real-time supply chain. I could find vendors that could put all together. Now imagine me speaking to my internet connection through my watch or my phone or my computer, saying, I would like to find people that make, who makes these? I want to design a prototype. It's got to have this, these lights, these. Design something for me, okay? Now all of a sudden I've got them. I'll send me an image of that. Now I'd like to now push that out onto the internet and offer that for sale. Amazon will host my store, and I'd like to promote it through Google and Facebook. And I'd like to take pre-orders for it, or maybe I'd like to launch it on Kickstarter or Indiegogo and raise some money. I can do all of that sitting in my living room in my sweats, hanging out on my deck, and I can create a virtual business overnight that could earn millions for me and my investors. Now, that's possible. Now, I have to do a lot of work to do that today. I have to kind of know where to go. And I imagine in a very near future, the Internet knows what I want. I can interact with it. It helps me kind of build the vendors, the manufacturers, supply chain, the digital currencies, the advertising platforms. We're pretty clear. If you know how to weave those things together now, you can have a pretty good business. And by the way, there's about 25% of the planet knows how to do that today. Tomorrow, that technology is going to get smarter and easier, and it's going to be more proactive, and technology will help enable us to build more productive, I think, enterprises and businesses and occupations. And that's a phase shift in how we think about work.
So that sounds to me, people are still in a pretty bad mood about the stock market and investments and not listening to good numbers. And as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking to myself, wow, that seems like that world is, of course, it's always rocky, but that basically that world's going to be okay, that investing world. Look what's coming.
Well, I think that world would be well, but keep in mind that 80% of all the trades on stock markets around the world, let's take 100 stock markets around the world, at least 80% of the trades that are done on the stock markets are undertaken by algorithms and programs and smart machines. Mm-hmm. Humans aren't doing those trading, right? Keep that in mind. That's another phenomenon in all this. It's humans harnessing smart machines to be able to, you know, create a better quality of life, if you will.
And interestingly enough, the Associated Press produces much of its business content through algorithms. You know,
exactly.
Stories about stock movements, they're not produced by writers. They're produced by algorithms. Right. So you have algorithms writing about algorithms, which show you just how deep this machine paradigm has shifted, you know, into our everyday culture where we don't even notice it.
Yeah, so the good, bad, and the ugly of all that, of course, is there will be wars over algorithms. There will be competition over algorithms. Algorithms will be determining which, you know, right now IBM's Watson, which is the biggest, you know, predictive analytics and artificial intelligence platform in the world, the deepest one, they're using it now to figure out how to heal cancer and how to advise people in terms of treatment for different diseases. So, this is a very different kind of world we're stepping into, and I think it's a better world, but of course it could also be a darker world based on where you are, and there could be threats to privacy and threats to security. And don't forget, the bad guys, rogue actors and folks that want to harm us, they could get access to some of these technologies as well, which is a problem.
And technology is always about trade-offs. We will take the convenience of it at the price of some security. The question is, for policymakers, is how do we embed certain policies in place that make good enough security for the really great trade-offs that technology will present. That's why I think, you know, members of Congress and politicians ought to read the book so they can be prepared to address these issues.
I would encourage all senators and Congress people to buy my book, read my book, and also buy them for their constituents in mass.
Airdrop them.
I like
are you curating right now?
I would subscribe to that. Any of our viewers want to buy them for their Congress people, I'm with you.
Hey, let's take a quick call. Sarah, hang on. Sarah, Faith Middleton, Rich Hanley, and Dr. James Canton, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, we're talking so much about how the technology is changing so rapidly, but the education system in our country has remained somewhat stagnant. I don't see it evolving as quickly in the classroom as it has everywhere else. How are we going to address that?
Thank you, Sarah. And Dr. Canton does talk about this in his book. I'm so glad you raised that. Thank you. Why don't you hang up and we'll get a quick answer from him. Yeah, just do education in a few seconds. Go ahead.
Could you repeat the question? It was hard for me
to
hear.
So education is not keeping up in terms of, we're talking about technology a lot on this show, and I was explaining that you have written about this. She said, you know, what are we going to do to get education to keep up with all these changes and to just get better?
Yeah, great question. Thanks. I've got a whole chapter on mm-hmm. on education, and I'm actively involved with my kids' education from 12 years old up to 22. I'm in my book. I go after education. We're too much of education is based on kind of mass market and the massification of the past. You know, I think that not enough of it looks forward. Not enough of it is getting people, you know, future ready, if you will. So I think, increasingly students, quite frankly, and I look at education, whether it's at the secondary, primary, or even at the college level, that students need to look out more and be drivers of getting institutions to make them more future ready. One of the problems and breakdowns we have is that kids or young adults are just not ready to enter the workforce, and most of my clients struggle with having to retrain the candidates as they come into organizations because they don't know what a supply chain is, or they don't know what an ROI is, or what a P&L is. They don't know how to, the fundamentals of a business, or they don't understand how to be able to do many of the things that they were trained for. I think education needs to be redesigned, reinvented. I don't think it's in sync with the realities of the changes that are happening in the business environment, and I think that that's a real serious problem. So in my book, I call for, with a lot of specific ideas about how to, just the process of education. We don't use technology. We don't use digital technology. And I'm not one to throw out humanities or to say we don't need interaction, it should all be virtual. No, I'm not saying that. But, we could be using technology more for simulations. The opportunity of building bridges between the private sector and education to starting at the youngest ages, we don't teach our kids how to, understand the basic economics of business, let alone how to be entrepreneurs. I think there's a lot of room for, not looking backwards, but looking forward, saying, okay, every institution should ask the question, whether you're teaching 5-year-olds or you're teaching 20-year-olds, everybody needs to understand how to, I think, learn how to program a computer, how to understand the breakthroughs that are transforming digital technology, physics, what's next for biology, the humanities. Everybody should understand how the economy works, and we should start all this very early on. So I think nothing less than a complete revamping of curricula, retraining of teachers. We've got to really take seriously, I think, in America, our school system, because we are not at the top of the scales when it comes to math, science, and education. And I think we deserve much better than we've got right now, and that goes to the educational leaders. I've had a very difficult time trying to get educational leaders at the college level to the principals, kind of wean them off of massified education and to get them to be innovative. The question I think is fair is, how do we get education future ready? What are the skills, capabilities, and competencies that make up a future ready civilization, and what are we doing to do that? Because quite frankly, I would throw out half of the curricula and I would retrain all of the teachers and probably replace much of the administration.
You're not gonna throw out liberal arts, are you?
No. I wouldn't throw out liberal arts. I wouldn't throw out humanities. I just think we need to rethink these. This is all based on the European model of silos. I don't think that anybody should get out of college or high school without understanding history, science, mm-hmm. humanities, mm-hmm. great books. I think those are important. Okay. Just how we've approached it is, think, is very, very mm-hmm. limited, and I think it only hurts our society. We're producing kids that don't know. Most Americans don't travel outside the United States. I understand.
Gotta run. I am so sorry. I hope you will come back on the show and we can talk about your book some more. Thank you, Dr. James Canton. Thank you, Rich Hanley, and our producers, Laurie Mack and Jonathan McNichol. His book is called Future Smart. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, recipes, value wines at the Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.